Sport March 2024 edition. My name's Sean Smith, and I'm joined by Sam Green.
Hello.
You all good, Sam?
All good, mate. All
Excellent.
Good. About yourself?
I'm all right. It's a long Easter weekend coming up, so 4 days of not having to do work is always good.
Well, I mean, speak for yourself, but...
What do you get, 10 minutes maybe?
Half a day.
If you're lucky.
No, I've got Saturday afternoon.
Okay. We'll do a rollback next month to see if you actually got that off or if you get called for an emergency. fortunately, we're not doing work. There's still motorsport happening. So, as usual, if you're not listening to this one, Motorsport 4, you should have done. It's a quick fire-ish 10 minutes topics talking about some of the biggest and smallest subjects in the world of motorsport within the month. So, start the clock. Topic number one. Peugeot have launched their new With a Wing hypercar, which they've helpfully kept the same name.
Well, it's essentially an update, isn't it? It's not a new car, it's a B-spec, basically.
Yeah.
So it's still the 9X8, and it still looks more or less the same as the 9X8. It's just sprouted a rear wing, essentially.
Yes. I personally think it looks great, but that's largely due to delivery, which we'll get straight out of the way. If we come to an award at the end of the year for best retro livery, obviously you've got the Toro Rosso one for the new, whatever you want to call it, V-carb team. Yeah. But off by reckon Peugeot going for their 2019 Bicolor style livery. Oof. It looks good. Hopefully it'll go a bit further than that car did at Le Mans.
Fingers crossed. It's a good-looking car. I quite liked the way the Peugeot looked even last year.
I didn't love the second livery, the white one they've had for the last few.
White and blue. Yeah, I mean, I thought that... I liked the grey.
Yeah.
It was just like super simple, effective. I quite liked the blue because it wasn't the grey, if that makes sense. It was a bit more vibrant.
Mm. To me, it was a bit too like, here's a marker board, write your logo on it.
Yeah, possibly. And then this new one is kind of a mixture of the two because it's grey, white, and like fluoro yellow, isn't it? But it looks good.
It does. We'll obviously be seeing it on track next month at the second round championship in Imola, which I suspect it will do absolutely terribly. I can't think of a worse, apart from maybe Sebring, I can't think of a worse track to debut essentially a new version of that car.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that I know they needed to introduce this as soon as, really, to update the car.
Yeah.
But and this was it's still the second oldest car on the grid, don't forget, after the Toyota.
Mm-hmm.
Putting a wing on before Le Mans feels counterproductive to me.
It's bold.
giving the car more drag just before you go to Le Mans.
They're saying that the Gen 1 9X8 was built to do Le Mans quickly. I'm not of the persuasion that Le Mans is actually a particularly smooth track. And where they would be gaining maybe in a straight line, that is pretty much dependent by the balance of performance in terms of your air restrictors, your power, and the rest of it.
Yeah.
Where you can deploy your hybrids. I don't think the actual shape of the car would make a big difference. We saw it was great in the wet, in the old spec. I would be surprised if this Gen 2 version has lost that ability, that advantage, because the car still has got the Venturi air tunnels going through it. It will still have a huge amount of underfloor downforce instead of, putting it all on top like a traditional car. We'll see, obviously.
Yeah, I think it probably did need an update. They hadn't done much with the old car, had they? It just started to come good.
It was a bit... A bit
slow burn.
Well, the fact that it had its best result until the last lap of the last race, where it should have
Yeah.
finished second.
Should have finished second.
And broke down. That was a kind of a
Yeah.
kick in the
Well, we
teeth.
ran out of fuel, I think,
I
wasn't
don't
it?
know
We pretty
whatever
much
it was.
broke
I was too busy being cross
down.
that Porsche got 1, 2, 3.
But they did actually lead that first round on merit. Like the car was good. They didn't just luck into that through other people's misfortune. The car was fast. Now Qatar is, I would say,
One of the
a
smoothest
very
tracks.
smooth circuit,
Yep.
so it should work well there, I guess. Yeah. So yeah, I mean the next couple is Imola. Have we got another race before Le Mans? I
Spa.
can't remember. Spa. Okay. The Spa maybe not too bad. Still a Grand Prix circuit, isn't it? I mean Imola is Grand Prix, but only just, let's face it. It's a small Grand Prix circuit.
Yeah, it's a bit, especially down the hill, it's bumpy. It's coming into every braking zone, it's bumpy. And it's also going to be incredibly tight. You're gonna have so much traffic around you.
Absolutely.
I don't think Imola's a particularly great choice for the WZ, in honesty.
No, I'm looking forward to watching it, but I
Yeah.
don't know as it's the option.
I love Imola. Again,
Yeah, same.
just don't think it's a very good choice.
No.
I get it. Monza is busy doing some sort of like modernization and stuff. I think they're changing the pit building or something. But
No, okay.
it's that's the reason they can't go. But I think
Okay.
just not having the Italian round and just coming to Silverstone would have been a better idea. But
Yeah.
we might be slightly biased on that.
Well, yes. No, I think we all want to see Silverstone back on the World Endurance calendar.
Well, the fact it's not is a ridiculous thing. Anyway, we're yammering. I think this should put Peugeot less out of kilter with the other cars when it does come to balance performance, which might help them in the long run because we have seen that the field is closer in one race so far this year. And hopefully that will carry through for the car and the team.
I mean, fingers crossed. I mean, the racing certainly in Qatar was very close. And the balance of performance is only going to get tweaked and adjusted to make it closer as the season goes on, in theory. So, yeah, I think fingers crossed. They're still more or less where they were on pace.
Would you
And with both cars.
like Peugeot to win Le Mans?
Ooh. It would be a good story, wouldn't it, for Peugeot to win Le Mans because it's the French team and the French race, and I think they deserve it probably more than Alpine.
Yes, that's not
But
difficult though, is it?
so I'd rather, if there's going to be a French team that wins it, I'd prefer it to be Peugeot rather than Alpine.
Not Orica in the LMP2.
I mean, that would be an incredible story as well, wouldn't it? An LMP2 wins outright.
Especially with this year's field of hypercars.
Yeah, there's a lot more to get rid of before an LMP2 win. So yeah, I mean that would be incredible, but I doubt it's going to happen. I mean, I'm still supporting Ferrari and World Endurance, so
Nope.
I prefer to see the 50 or the 51
More
win it, or even.
than happy for them to win over most other marks, but Toyota.
Well, of course.
Been my team for nearly 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah, since day dot. Yeah, no, I still think the 499P is the most beautiful car on the grid. One of the most beautiful race cars in the world currently, so
But you heard it here first, chaps. that's a Sam Green seal of approval.
yeah.
I think the Porsche's better looking, but whatever.
You're incorrect, Sean.
there's the second World Endurance Championship story this month, which Sam told me 5 to 10 minutes ago.
Yes, and that is because it was only published this morning. We're recording this on the 28th, because obviously tomorrow is like bank holiday, so can't do that work. But basically, World Endurance are set to introduce a minimum of two cars per manufacturer.
I think this is absolutely bloody ridiculous.
Yes. Oh, actually, it's hang on, I've just read here. Oh, okay, two factory. Okay, so that would also mean that, that you can't have more than two cars per team. So you can't have three Toyotas, for example, without one of them being a customer car.
Okay, that's more that bit's fine because that's been the case for Le Mans for decades. You know, remember Audi Sport had to run Audi Sport North America to get their third car on the grid.
Yes, yeah, and in the same way that currently this year we have AF Corsa Ferrari and AF Corsa running the yellow one. So, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be out of the question, really, would it, for that to be the case. But it does mean that even teams like Cadillac and Lamborghini are going to be up against it because they're going to have to get another car on the grid. And then a very good point raised by Autosport as well. Heart of Racing are trying to develop that Aston Martin, the Valkyrie, aren't they?
Yes.
Now, they've only got one of those. So is that to put pay to that project entirely?
I think it is another move by the ACO and the FIA to basically stick their fingers up at privateers and single entrants. I've made my points very clear on this, that I think it's absolutely the wrong thing to do. It's short-sighted. It's going to probably please the big boys, but how many times has the top class of Le Mans capitulated essentially because of things get bad, everyone leaves, you're left with one team and a bunch of privateers, and if you're getting rid of the privateers, you're just going to stuff yourself over in the future.
Well, no, exactly that. And as we've seen, like in the last few years, you need those small teams sometimes to help keep the series going as much as anything. It's the same thing that we said about like the Baikales and all of their efforts over previous years, as they may be. We always sort of take the mickey a little bit out of them.
You take the mickey out of them.
Me and Shaw, me and Alistair and Chris always take the mickey out of them a little bit, mostly to wind up Sean. But you have to say they did a very good job for the series because they kept a car on the grid for a long time with really
no budget.
No budget, no real development.
They didn't even do it the easy way by buying a pre-made LMP2 car with a body kit on it.
Exactly, they built their own car, and even when they were running LMP1, again they built their own car for this. They may have bought an engine, but that's neither here nor there, really. That's just what you do. In a lot of sports cars is like that. Yeah, without those small teams, you're going to struggle when things get tough.
Well, we all know that some manufacturers, maybe one German one and one American one, are pretty likely to quit before too long. Let's just say that's likely, rather than, you know, guaranteed. Alpine, who knows? And just on time, we've got our third and most prolific guest, the Montesaurus, is here.
Well, good evening, guys. How are we doing?
Very well, thank you. Monty, how are you?
Oh, never better, never better. Ready for a long weekend of chocolatey goodness.
Excellent. We've already made that joke, but it's all... Sam's got about 14 seconds of break.
It's good to see we're all on the same wavelength.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Right, on to topic number two. Unfortunately, Monty, it's the boring one. It's Formula One. It started this month.
Oh no, Formula One again.
Yes.
Great.
Sorry.
What a shame.
Start the clock. Right. Big news. Max Verstappen has lost a race.
Yes. So the biggest news was last weekend's Australian Grand Prix, where Max Verstappen had a rather dramatic brake explosion 5 laps in, which opened the door up for someone else to actually win.
But
that is the driver who's currently on the dole. It's Carlos Sainz, job seeker's allowance. As when he has won a race.
I mean, to be fair, he's not actually left his current job yet, so he's not technically going to be on job six lands. Also, I think you have to be out of work for 6 months before you can qualify for that. Plus, you also need to have a certain amount of money in the bank before you can actually claim it. But apart from that, Sam, that was a really good analogy. Well done.
Let's just say he's handed in his P45 and is seeing out his notice.
I don't think he handed it in.
Okay, fine. His employees handed him the P45. Like, arrivederci. Yes. Ciao.
He's on gardening leave. He's just seeing out his notice, basically, yeah. And that done. But he's also the only non-Red Bull driver to have won a race in the last 2 years. Yeah. So...
yes, it's Jordan. Yes. Yeah, definitely this year and last year, yes. Now, what if, here's a big what if, chaps. What if Carlos Sainz wins the championship?
Oh, could you imagine?
It won't happen.
Could you imagine? It's very, I don't think it's going to happen because he missed a race as well, which I'm sure we can come on to in a minute. Maybe that's the reason he won, because he was 200 grams lighter. his lack of appendix.
I honestly think it's still going to be the Max Verstappen show this year. Mm. And the only way this is going to be an interesting season now is if these reliability woes continue throughout the season. Otherwise, if this is just a blip in the ocean, then I think it's just going to be more of the same for the next 20 races.
A blip in the ocean? That's a new one, Motti. That's quite original. I like that.
Thank you. I'm really mixing up my words today. I do apologise, everyone. But, hey, this is what adds to entertainment factors, right?
I mean,
Dropping the ocean. There we are. Dropping the ocean. That's what I meant.
Considering you got literally 5 minutes of notice before we went on, you've done all right. Right.
Oh, thank you.
Now, obviously, Red Bull with the... is it the RB20 this year? I can't remember.
Years.
It's quite good, isn't it? It's fairly fast. Goes around tracks quickly. Do we think it's going to be a case like last year, but with maybe more opportunities at some tracks for others to compete? Or do you think it really will just be, unless reliability kicks in or a random weather event or something like that, it's going to be like it was the first two races where Max Verstappen goes off into the distance and nothing happens afterwards?
He's certainly got control. I mean, race one, he qualified by 2.5 tenths. Race two, 0.3 of a second. Australia, 0.3 of a second again to second place. So you feel like he's got the races under control. I still believe there is reserve in pace there to go even quicker if he really needed to. He hasn't really stressed himself so far in any of the races so far this season.
Exactly. Quite impressive, really.
Yeah, hence why I think the only time we're going to see them get threatened is because there's a reliability issue. Otherwise, I think they've got another stonking car again this year.
Now, obviously here, Red Bull can't go for the all wins in a season record, but could they get all poles in a season?
I mean, quite possibly. Verstappen has always been good at qualifying, let's face it. And if the car allows it, I'm sure he will be pushing pretty hard to get that record. And it would be quite an impressive one if he can do that, 24 in a season. But yeah, I think it's... I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I think they've definitely got the best car, Red Bull. I think the field, Ferrari and McLaren definitely seem closer. Mercedes at certain circuits seem a bit closer as well. I think they may not win every other race this year, but it's going to be the majority of the field.
Okay, then let's switch it around for the second half. Let's talk about Alpine. Yeah. Le Frenchies.
It's really bad.
It's beyond atrocious, I think, is what I'm calling it, because I thought Alpine would have a tick up this year.
Interesting. You're about the only person I've heard to say that.
Yes, this was before pre-season testing. Was it just after the car launches, Sam?
It was still pre-season. It was the day after the last car launch.
Yeah.
In fact, Red Bull launched their car during
the podcast. It's just, they say it was a brave choice. Others might say misinformed. You know, it's just, we've seen Peugeot have a B-spec car. Let's see how quickly Renault can get one. It's more than, as we always say with these sort of things, it's more of a waste of the talent at Enstone than it is, you know, bad for Gasly and Ocon or any one of the directors or Renault the brand or anything like that.
Well, we say that, but a lot of the engineers have sort of jumped ship there
Well,
as well, haven't they?
yeah, but it's still wasted work, isn't it? It's and those who are left behind are now left clutching this shit stick. It's obviously we've known for the, since at least last year that Renault's, sorry, Alpine's management is not the most stable of platforms. The it's been reported for years that Renault have kind of over Renault the car company rather than Renault the race team have always sort of overarched what they want through their racing brand rather than necessarily allowing it to be a race team. You know, weird ideology. Not sure why anyone would ever do that. And I think it is showing. It's showing in the management unable to do what they need to do. It's showing in probably a lot of pressure coming from managers and then pressing down on their lower employees. I don't know this obviously, but it's I don't know. It's causing a lot of problems, and obviously this year is showing it at the moment.
Absolutely. The car's just nowhere. It's just really not good. Can't see it getting much better unless they can bring big updates and do it quickly. But yeah,
It's
that's going to be a tall order.
a bad mix as well because, on percentage terms, in the wider history of Formula One, they'd be probably they what one and a half or two up to maybe 2% off. 20 years ago, that'd have probably been second row. obviously not that close, but it's a bad set of circumstances that it's also the year where the midfield backwards is apart from Sauber are extremely close in race trim and qualifying trim.
Yeah, I'd agree there. The field is quite closely stacked. So losing a couple of percent here or there is going to massively affect you. Both cars in the order, and it could mean the difference between getting a point and not getting a point, or just finishing stone dead last or just off of the last. And they all count. All of the results count, even if it's not points. Don't forget, they still goes off of best results and things like that. If it's a tie at the end of the season, and there is a good chance that they could be in that situation with no points if they keep going like this. I guess we'll have to see, won't we?
Monty, what's your view?
Well, they certainly can't go any worse now. They've kind of done a Williams from 5 years ago.
I think it's quite similar. That's a pretty good parallel, actually.
Yep, no, it feels like that. There's a lack of leadership. I think the only thing that they have in their advantage at the moment is they have good resources. So you never know. This could be a kind of Aston Martin 2022 situation where they start off the season bad and then they turn it around in the second half of the season, become regular point scorers and start threatening the podium. But they need the leadership. And at the moment, it's been such a turbulent place to work for the last 12 months that I don't actually see how they can do that. For a better word, as I keep on slagging off the French for being. Oh, God, let's try that one again. Because I keep on telling off Ferrari in most of these podcasts for being too Italian and they need some more structured leadership, I'm going to use the same thing but apply it to the French here. Alpine have become too French and are letting their pride get in the way of, well, actually working together and making things happen. Because they've got all the ingredients there. They have two decent drivers, they have decent engineers, they have fantastic facilities. But if the people aren't working well together, then, well, what hope have they got? That's
I
great.
would like to put in one caveat to there is that their one part that's not necessarily working is their engine. It is the weakest on the grid. But, however, that is due to everyone ditching Renault over the last 10 years for precisely that reason. The FIA, however, not allowing them to give an upgrade, I think is unfair is the wrong word. Maybe on sporting, I don't know. But yeah,
well, I would agree with you there. If there's clearly an issue, then why, especially like between seasons, I don't understand why they couldn't redevelop that engine and bring out a new spec engine. Well, as long as it passes all the scrutineering tests, then surely it's fine.
Back in the VA days, Renault, along with Honda, used to be allowed to have minor upgrades. So if they were clearly behind on that front, they were allowed to bring upgrades on the condition that they were for reliability, and there was some other one they were allowed. And it worked. You know, it did generally. There wasn't a obvious weak engine back in those days. Yeah. Obviously, they're more complicated and more difficult now. I think they've been dealt a bad hand, and it's going to take time. Like Monty says, it's like Williams a few years ago.
Yeah, no, I can see that. Should we mention Williams?
they're doing okay.
They're doing okay.
Except when they're not.
Maybe not quite the fifth place that I was hoping for in our pre-season podcast. But the main worrying thing I found is the fact they didn't, Australia, where didn't have a spare chassis. Three races into the season, didn't have a spare.
Did you see the video from the Dash Race about Williams's MRP structure, essentially, and how they build the car?
Lack of.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah, I've heard there was a huge spreadsheet, basically, which no one could make head nor tails of, basically. And so it was all just carnage.
I have to say that, firstly, fair play to Williams and fair play to James Vowles for being so transparent about...
This is what I said in the pre-season. I think it's the best thing for the team.
I would have buried it if I was team principal.
No, never mind the team. I think it's the best thing for the audience to understand, because ever since Liberty Media have acquired F1, they've just made it all about drama. And I'm probably being biased here, given that I've got a degree in engineering, but I find it so frustrating. Because if I wanted drama, I'd go and look at Big Brother. I'd go and look at Gogglebox and stuff like that, and what people bicker it out, hammer and tongs.
Or Bob the Builder.
Or Bob the Builder, yes. This has been, for me, a refreshing and huge breath of fresh air. That someone is not only talking engineering, but is talking about it in a relatable manner, which means that not only me as an engineer can understand it, but Joe Bloggs can understand it as well. Yeah. I also give Williams huge kudos for being this transparent about their journey back to the front, as they call it, because I think it really does show, for a better word, how much of a wonderful job Claire Williams had done of mismanaging that team for the last 10 years, because who uses a spreadsheet in an F1 team nowadays? Mid-90s, that would have been like the technical forefront. But F1 teams now have bespoke systems. They all have like a technical partner now, either SAP or someone like that, that will develop these kind of database systems for their needs. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. The fact that Williams are still using a spreadsheet in 2024, well, one, fair play that they've been able to be this successful with what is obviously such outdated technology, which James Vowles has even been very transparent about last year. He said, we're about 10 years behind the other teams with regards to our resources. I think that has just really highlighted and was a textbook example of what he was talking about last year, and why everything we see them do at the moment really is a giant killing performance, because they just do not have the resources to compete with the other nine teams. So actually, every single point that they've scored just shows what an efficient job they are doing with the resources they have in comparison to, for example, Alpine,
who are sponsored by or were sponsored by Microsoft, funnily enough.
That's my two cents anyway.
It was good. I liked it.
I think James Vowles is superb. This is what I said in our pre-season. I think he is definitely, if Williams are going to come back to where we think Williams should be,
what, which 10th? Is
No, challenging podiums and getting good results, and like how Williams were back in the day, like get a proper race team. James Vowles, I think, is the one to bring them back to it. And I think the way he's doing it is fantastic. Like you said, he's super transparent. He's very honest about it. And I think that for the fans, that's really important. That they feel more part of the team in that situation now. That's what I thought anyway, watching those videos, is that you feel like this was a debrief, an actual post-race debrief. It is proper engineering stuff. And that's what the fans want, let's face it. Like, I don't know many, obviously I work in an industry where I see a lot of young drivers. You do not see many Williams fans because they've been at the back for a long time. However, our generation...
But their dads.
Different story. My dad, huge Williams fan, always has been a massive Williams fan. I'm a bit of a Williams fan. I'm a McLaren fan, really, but like, I want Williams to do well. I really like Williams. So I think he is superb, and I think he's the one that's going to bring him back. It's just going to take time, basically, as much as anything.
We shall see.
Unfortunately, yes. But it is coming along slowly and surely. It's just, unfortunately, with incidents like that, it does show how vulnerable the team are still to setbacks.
Well, it was a two-pronged thing, because they were updating putting in an MRP system. But there's another structure that they were doing, which I've forgotten. I'm more sorry. If anyone who does want more information, do watch the Dash Races video. It goes into quite a lot of detail about what they've actually done over the winter. It is quite extraordinary. They've even got two cars out on the grid, to be honest. But on that bombshell, we need to move on to topic three. Yeah. Such is the nature of the show. Bit different this month. We're going to be talking not about a specific motorsport topic necessarily, you know, a race or team news or drivers or anything like that. We're going to be talking about we're going to talk about autism, and we're going to talk about learning difficulties and how in motorsport they can be far from barriers. It can be actually benefits for a lot of people. Monty, you were recently on telly, I believe.
Yes, I was interviewed by the BBC about this as part of Neurodiversity Celebration Week. It's something I'm autistic myself, so it's something I've always been very transparent about. And something I'm eager to get other people to be more comfortable, I would say, to have a conversation on neurodiversity, because it impacts so many people and touches so many people's lives, be it either because the individual is neurodivergent themselves, perhaps they know a colleague at work. Almost every person I've ever met will, when I tell them I'm autistic, their response is, "Oh, I've got a cousin with that," or "Oh, I've got a friend with that." So it's a lot more popular than I think people realise, because the latest stats show that 15 to 20% of the UK population is neurodivergent. Now, there's a lot of myths with regards to neurodiversity. I think a lot of people still see neurodiversity as being something which means it's an intelligence issue.
That's what I want to get onto.
Absolutely, yeah. It could either be an intelligence issue, or certainly when I had my diagnosis as a child, the headmaster at my school advised my parents that it was unlikely I'd be able to pass my GCSEs, and pushing trolleys at a supermarket was my realistic career goal. And actually, in the last 25 years, as society continues to understand more about what is neurodiversity, we're seeing more and more neurodivergent people not only getting through their GCSEs, but getting onto further education as well. They're going to university, they're leaving with degrees, and they have an opportunity now to, for a better word, live a fully independent life and be able to go to work, whereas 30 years ago, it was almost a write-off for a lot of people, which was, it just shows how far our understanding has come. And actually, I would say there's, with retrospect, a lot of people that we've seen in the past who would probably fit under the criteria of being neurodivergent. And even with or without the diagnosis, they found a way to cope. They found a strategy which worked for them, which has allowed them to succeed in their life. And that really is the main thing about neurodiversity, is that we're talking about a different way of thinking. It's a different way of skinning the cat, per se. But you may still come to the same conclusion. And that really has been the positive takeaway last week with all the webinars, all the events around the country, which was celebrating people's neurodiversity, was that actually let's have a conversation on it, because perhaps what one person is comfortable with doing in their work, you know, this is the task, I've always done it this way because this is what I know best. Well, actually, here comes someone with a very different viewpoint on life, and they've been able to show you a much more efficient way of completing that whole task. Mm. And so it really should be, these conversations have always been about celebrating that person's individualness and that uniqueness that they bring, because their skill set can complement a team, it can complement a workplace. And motorsport is no different to any other industry out there.
Yeah, Sam and I were talking about this before before the start of the podcast a bit. I'm not going to go into personal details, just due to who it is. But I do know people who are, as the term goes, on the spectrum. And they are some of the most intelligent people I know. So, as you said, Monty, the old school idea of, you know, you're autistic or have other problems is the wrong word. So forgive me for using it.
It's all right. It's interesting, actually, Sean, because just listening to you stammer over some of the words, don't take this the wrong way, but this has been the one thing I've noted, particularly last week, is I think there's a lot of people out there with very good intentions and want to do their bit to help and to support and make a better society. But I'm aware there's so much noise on social media as to what is the correct neuro-inclusive language to use, that kind of how you're speaking right now, Sean, is how I hear a lot of people speak about it. Am I using the right word, or so the term is? Oh, yes. No, it's absolutely fine. That is the term. Autistic is the correct word to use. So don't be afraid to use that word. It's three syllables. It's nice and simple.
Yeah,
actually, let's all try it together right now. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Autistic.
Autistic. Yeah.
Autistic.
Yeah. Thank you. There we are.
Excellent.
Carry on.
Thank you. Anyway, yes. So my point was that with the autistic people I know, they might not have been the easiest time in the school system, for example. However, but that's because school systems are a regimented, this is how you're going to learn, get over it. And that does... that it does stop people who have the autistic spectrum from achieving what they might, because they might be rubbish at, say, English grammar, for example, but they might be incredible at maths. Again, I know a personal example of this, and because they've been told to get the baseline of the jack of all trades kind of thing, they essentially do lose out in what they might specialize in. And this is where I wanted to get to motorsport, because when people get, especially to university, if they get that far due to the way that education system works in this country, they can be actually incredible minds if you're able to pique their interest, show them what needs to be done, or tell them what needs to be done. And they've got the right people behind them, the right tools, the right just general attitude around them. Because a lot of autistic people do struggle with crowds, as you see in school classrooms, as you see in a lot of things. It's very much the case that if you give them space, give them time, give them an objective, give them a resource, you'll probably get a better result because they will focus. They will get to not only the right conclusion, but as Monty says, a more efficient one, a much cleaner result. It will be that they might have a million formulas that they've gone through, but it proves the point that it will, and it's. And yes, as you say, I think it is very much the case that the world does need to change still a lot in order to actually appreciate these people. It's not. Disability has a horrible word to it. I've dealt with it my entire life. I hate it. It's very easy to associate that word with negativity. And I think that needs to change a lot going forward.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting world we live in at the moment because, particular. So just to clarify for any of the audience, when we talk about disability, so in the UK, neurodiversity, autism, dyslexia, ADHD, etc., is officially recognised as a disability in the UK, hence why we're making the reference. I'm aware that in other places of the world, America, for example, it's almost on a state-by-state case basis. And so I'm aware that we still have people who would much prefer to say autism is a difference rather than a disability. I fully support whatever you say because we're in this nice situation now in the world where, thankfully, some of those crass words, the R words, the C word, which rhymes with ripple, are no longer used in society. And if they are, they are really frowned upon. And the majority of people say that's not acceptable. That's a really good place to.
A lot of people don't say that, which is the problem. It was definitely the case when I was growing up that anybody who was singled out with anything was bullied and was made an example of.
When I say nowadays, I literally do mean in the last 10 years because I fully echo everything you're saying there. My childhood, well, I was put on my own table until the end of year four because teachers didn't quite know how to support me because I was just distracting other kids in the class. I mean,
I was taken out of the classroom.
There you go. I mean, isn't that just a green light to go, right, that's the odd one out, so that must be the one that we get to go and pick on. So we have come so far in even the last 20 years. It's really... it's moving. It really is moving. Don't get me wrong, there's still a long way to go. It very much is a culture thing. But we are making strides in the right direction. It's nice, from my point of view, that we're now in a situation where, even since my childhood, I don't hear people openly using the R words in a social environment as the literal term now. It's the language is evolving, it's much more positive, it's much more collaborative. It's a little bit of a funny situation, though, because, well, for example, at my work, so when I was talking about this last week at work, I have four different generations of employees and, or colleagues, I should say, of 40 different nationalities. So that's a lot of different versions of normal, definitions of normal being thrown around. And that almost in itself can create a barrier because if you say neurodiversity to 300 people, you're probably going to get 300 different definitions as to what neurodiversity means. Now, so long as it's not actually offending someone, well, yes, quite rightly, when it comes to the language, there is a line in the sand as to what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. But that line can almost be defined by each individual now because neurodiversity, autism, like all forms of disabilities, it is personal to that person, that individual and that individual only. Because you'll never have two autistic people who are the same. You'll never have two people missing a limb who are the same either. Their needs are always going to be unique. And it's great to see that when we have a conversation on these labels now, we're almost using it to kickstart the conversation, to help point someone in the direction quicker, to identify how can we support them so they can do the rest of the hard work themselves, because we know that they can do it, because in the case of an autistic person, we know they have intelligence. As we say, autism is never about their intelligence now. It's always been, it's a communication thing. So let's focus on their communication need so we can identify how to get them to the finish line so they can do the work themselves, because undoubtedly they've got the knowledge to do that. Sean, are you able in this podcast to include any images afterwards, or is it not that kind of podcast?
In the recording?
Yeah.
No.
Dang, okay. No worries. I wanted to share what the autistic spectrum looks like as my example.
We can put all the links on the website, so anyone, please do go on the page and look at any of those. That won't be a problem at all.
Fantastic. Awesome. In that case, so I'm just sharing with you guys now an image, just to show the example of what I'm trying to explain here, and just to show how far things have evolved, even 20 years, because in this first image, which I'm going to talk about, this is how autism was seen at the time when I had my diagnosis in the late 90s. It was what they call the ruler theory, where you were either very autistic or not very autistic. And back in the late 90s, I was actually officially diagnosed with what they called high-functioning Asperger syndrome. So that was kind of seen at the time as being, well, it's a form of autism, but you're not that autistic because you can speak. Whereas nowadays, we know that's not correct. And actually, that's a bit of an outdated terminology to use. Because, I mean, could you imagine if I turned around to you and said, oh, you're a bit low-functioning? That would be quite offensive to say to someone. Yes, again. So quite rightly, that language is gone now because it's just not acceptable. And the way that we look at autism has changed, because it's not a case of you either have Asperger syndrome or you have autism. No, Asperger syndrome falls within the whole autistic spectrum. The word spectrum being the key word here, because we've moved away from this ruler theory now. And the images which I'm referencing, by the way, guys, comes from the National Autistic Society. And so, as we say, we'll have the link supplied to you. But, I mean, this second image, this is a much more representative way of how you should look at autism, in the same way as how you should look at all forms of neurodiversity, because it is a spectrum, because you could have two autistic people whose needs are very, very different. Now, per the textbook, autistic people can't speak. They have social issues. That's an old school myth. Well, I'm doing a pretty good job of chatting at the moment, so I'm certainly putting that theory to bed straight away now. But as you can see on the spectrum there, it's actually a wheel with different slices of the pie, shall we say. Each of those slices are representing a different quirk, if you may, or characteristic of a person's behaviour. So in this image that you're looking at here, we have social skills, fixations, routines, sensory issues, stimming, so that's like involuntary movement, fidgets, not quite tics, but like people that you see sometimes doing like a little tap with their feet or flapping their hands around because they get too excited. So that's what we mean by stimming. Perception of situations, your executive function skills, as well as other things to consider as well. Now, when you look at autism on the spectrum, you can see how each section of it has filled out to highlight where someone's strengths and weaknesses are. Now, firstly, this makes it much easier for a coach or for a specialist in autism to identify someone's needs as to what you need to focus on for their coaching. What do we need to support them through from an equity point of view to ensure that they have the same opportunities as anyone else? So using me as an example here, I would probably fill out the social skills part quite nicely because I'm quite a charismatic person. I don't really have that many fixations nowadays. I used to when I was a kid. That was kind of where a lot of my coaching was focused on, because these fixations would take over my whole day to the point that I'd forget to actually do my actual work. And so that for me was something which I had to focus on in getting some coaching, getting some support on, to, so I could understand what I needed to prioritize in a day. But I still have sensory issues. You know, light is an issue for me. Sudden noises really overwhelm me. Fire alarms in particular in the building, they leave me with tinnitus and spots in my vision. So that's just a pure sensory overload for me, and something which I'm aware is a weak point for me. Whereas you may get another autistic person, and when you fill out their spectrum, perhaps they don't have very social, very good social skills. They can't speak that much. But actually, their routines and their fixations, they have strict routines and they're very fixated on specific subjects. Now, suddenly, they can use those subjects to their strength and excel at, pun intended, working on data sheets and spreadsheets, because that's just the way their brain works. And suddenly, you've got someone who's an absolute whiz and can bring that kind of level of talent to a team who no one else would be able to tolerate that, because looking at spreadsheets are god-awful, but this individual enjoys that. It's also for that reason, when you look at the spectrum like that, it makes much more sense as to why we say no two autistic people are the same. You've met a person with autism, well, great, you've met a person with autism. And, oh dear, head's just gone blank now. Person with autism, blah, 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 blah. So you can tell it's been a long day here. Okay, I remember. May want to edit this little bit out and just restart from here.
That will happen.
Oh, well, never mind. Well, we'll just start
as Sam well knows, we don't edit.
That's fine. No editing then. Right, I'll just start from the beginning again then. So, when you look
hi, and welcome to this Off-Road Motorsport March Edition.
Not quite that beginning. But no, when you look at autism in the eyes of the spectrum, so when you compare two autistic people this way rather than through the conventional ruler, well, compare it to a pair of glasses. You could have two people who need a pair of glasses, and you put the pair of glasses on the first person and it's improved their eyesight. And then you go and stick the same pair of glasses on another person, well, it's actually made their eyesight worse, because someone could be long-sighted and someone could be short-sighted. Exactly the same logic applies here in autism, like it does in all forms of neurodiversity as well. It really is an individual thing, and it really is about getting to know the person. And that's where we're kind of heading in the journey. This is where the language is evolving to make it much more engaging. It's been 25 years since my diagnosis, and as part of my journey, I've almost had to re-understand myself, because I'm not Aspie Monty anymore. I can't say Asperger because that offends people. So I've had to adapt to telling people I'm autistic. That was part of my journey. Give it another 25 years, maybe they will just do away with neurodiversity, autism, and just call it a people spectrum. That would be the ultimate goal, because actually you can throw so many labels at this. And I see so many people invest so much of their time on Facebook, on social media, telling people off for using the wrong words. And whilst it's important to have the correct language, it's even more important to have allies. And I find a lot of allies are scared from wanting to help out or even start a conversation because they're that worried they're going to use the wrong word. And ironically, the best allies I've had in my life were the old school teachers. They were the ones who, their training was from a generation where students were either smart or stupid. They wore the dunce cap. They had no idea what learning difficulties were. But they recognised someone who wanted to try, wanted to put the effort in, but wasn't quite getting it. And they spent just a little bit of extra time understanding what my needs were so they could point me in the right direction and then let my talents do the rest. And that, to me, is key into getting more neurodivergent people through education, because I think it's only about a 60% pass rate at the moment, if we're going to look at it that way. Only about 60% of neurodivergent students are fully completing education. But more importantly, how we can create a neuro-inclusive working environment for them. Because ironically, we've got them through education, we get them into the industry, we get them into the workplace, and they're leaving just as quickly because all those struggles they used to have at school are back in the workplace now because that specialist training from the teachers, from the nurses, from the staff isn't there anymore. They're back in the real world with people. Mm. And everyone needs an ally. And that's kind of what I've been doing for the last week, and just to help celebrate those uniqueness that everyone has, embrace the skills that they can offer to a team. But also, yeah, just to help raise awareness as to, well, what does autism look like? And when we talk about the spectrum, well, what does it look like? And I hope that these images will help illustrate to people, just even when we talk about it and we use a tag, at the end of the day, it's still just a person. Just spend a little bit of time to get to know the person, and actually you don't need to worry about the autism part. You've just got someone who's obsessed with cars and wants to do a bit of engineering.
Yeah. Hello. I like trains. That's all us.
Hello.
I think most of us fall into that category.
All engineers, probably confirmed, probably on the autism switchboard somewhere.
Oh, God, yes. An absolute spurg fest in engineering. Yeah. No, I'm joking. But no, sorry, I went on a complete rant there, but I hope that it gives a bit of a flavours to the kind of work I've been doing. And as I say, very, very thankful that the BBC wanted to interview me to, I guess, find out more about my experiences and what more we could be doing to support people out there.
Yeah. Sam, we basically managed to like completely get rid of all your points and take them all through this one.
Well, no, it's sort of one. It's a conversation. Obviously, you guys have had a lot more experience with throughout your lives. Certainly, in my last few years of working life, generally, is sort of coaching various drivers of varying ages as well, not just kids but adults as well that are on the autistic spectrum. Actually, I think motorsport can be a really good environment for people that have got different ways of approaching problems. That's part of motorsport. That's I was telling Sean before we started, I've got two drivers that immediately spring to mind for me. One of them, I won't mention his name because I don't know him that well, sort of thing. But he, one of his fixations essentially was his racing lines, which means he is probably the most accurate driver I have ever seen on a go-kart. Like, he's just like inch perfect, millimeter perfect on where he should brake, turn, accelerate, apex. He knows all of it because that's what he does. He fixates on that and he learns it. He does the time, he figures it out and he learns it. And then when I say to him, well, actually, I think you can brake slightly later for that corner, or try just turning here. A lot of some drivers, especially younger drivers, will take a handful of laps to get into that, and they won't always be able to do it or whatever it is, but there's that sort of element of, no, that's what I've been told to do, so I'm going to do it. And he will go and do it every single lap. And if it works for him, he'll say, yeah, that was better. And if it doesn't, he'll tell me it wasn't better. So that's fine. I don't mind that. The feedback's good. But as well, I think with that kind of what you were saying, guys, about that kind of, where once you said your teacher had sort of kept you on a table on your own, Sean, you weren't even in the room because you were, in inverted commas, disruptive.
I wasn't disruptive, I was disabled.
Okay, yes, but but I know for a fact that another driver who I will mention, because I know his dad is actually, he's now trying to help Motorsport UK be more inclusive towards neurodivergency and various bits and pieces. So Stuart Spencer and his son Oliver, who I did quite a lot of work with in his first sort of season and a half of karting, where yeah, when I was giving him instructions, we walked out of the pit lane. We went back to the paddock area where it was a bit quieter. There's less people. And we would go through stuff and methodically go through it. And after that, he understood it. And then he did it. If I tried to do that in the pit lane, where there's other kids running around that have just come off track and he's a bit sort of full of adrenaline after a session and stuff like that, it wouldn't sink in. And his dad says, to this day, karting is the only thing that he can focus on.
Well, drivers do say, don't they, that when you're in a cockpit with the driver's helmet on, you are in your zone, as they say.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And he gets overstimulated. In environments like school where there's chatting going on and he's got to try and read the board and write something down and stuff like that, he struggles. But he puts his crash helmet on and everything's a bit quieter and he can understand it, he can do it, and then he goes and does it. And he was third in the world last year in Micromax. An absolutely astonishing result in his second season of karting. To go and be in the world finals for Rotax, to be anywhere near the best in the world, is an absolutely phenomenal result for him. And then to be quickest the whole week and just lose out in the final was absolutely gutting. But he just, yeah, he put the effort in and he got the result that he, not quite the result he wanted because he wanted to win, but like he did an unbelievably good job. And I think that what you're saying with, yeah, having the right allies, having the right team around you, again, comes from motorsport, I think, a little bit. And that can all help.
We are going to have to leave it there, just due to, because we are. but Monty, please do give as many other resources for me to put on the website as you can, and I will be sure to share them.
Absolutely.
That's it for this one from the Motorsport March Edition. Bit different, bit special. No, I can't say that. Oh God, that was entirely not meant to. Yeah. Anyway, now what's next month? April.
April.
What's happening in April?
Imola.
Yes.
For World Endurance, and I think as well for Formula One.
Suzuka in April for once.
Yes.
We'll see about that. That'll be.
It's also this weekend, so kind of April, is the Safari Rally.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that. I'm actually bothered following it for once.
Yeah. Cars with snorkels on. This is the rainy season in Kenya, so it's very, very wet and muddy.
So there you go. For more excitement and topics, follow us next month. Follow us on social media. That's Devil Auto. And we'll see you for the next one. Thank you very much for Sam and Monty for joining me.
It was a pleasure.
Pleasure as always is all yours.
You know it, my friend, you know it. We'll see you next time. Take care and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Alrighty.
Good.